Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team. Welcome back to the Predictable Revenue Podcast. I'm your host, Colin Stewart. Today, I'm joined by a guy who's, he's been a number of things. He's currently the founder of Buena Vista Ventures, but he's also been the guy that I negotiate our SASTR sponsorship package with. He's been the guy over at Zen Cargo that's getting their sales team together. He built MixMax's first sales team from 0 to 12, built Flexport's sales team from 8 to 30, and you might remember him from Zenefits when he went from 0 to 250 sales reps. Everybody, welcome Robbie Allen to the show. Robbie, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Colin. I am a longtime listener and fan and happy to be here.
Right on, man. Jason said he'd give us a great deal on the sponsorship for next year if we had you on the show and mentioned that.
You've already got a pretty great deal. That
yeah, totally putting words in his mouth. But I'm really excited to have you on the show because, one, we've interacted a ton of times. You and I met back when you're in your Zenefits days, albeit briefly, because you were absolutely slammed. But I think you've got a unique skill set and obviously a unique set of experience. And there aren't too many people out there that have gone from 0 to 12 reps, let alone 0 to 250 reps. And so where I think we're going to sort of triangulate in for the episode is talking about the sort of, one, scaling sales teams, but two, sort of what the different stages of scaling looks like and the things that you need to do differently at each stage.
Yeah, I love it. I think there are kind of three unique stages along the way. And I'm excited to dive in and give a couple examples, from each of these experiences I've had.
Cool. And so let's talk about the stages first. So what are the, like at a high level, what are the, like, how do you see the stages of sort of sales growth?
Yeah. So I think, we're talking about startup companies here. So this isn't about how to take, your company from, being public to staying listed for 25 years. It's a little bit more kind of how to go from zero to something. And so there's kind of three main stages. The first one is product market fit. And the next is repeatability and scale. And the third is hypergrowth. And I like to draw a lot of parallels to sports. I played sports growing up, and basketball is kind of you can't tell from where I'm sitting right here next to the Golden Gate Bridge, but I'm a basketball player. And I think the way that I like to kind of think about this is in product market fit, all you're really trying to do is figure out where a mismatch is and just take advantage of that mismatch and survive. And when you're going more for repeatability and scale, now you're actually like running a play where there's like kind of multiple things happening at once, and you can run it with a pretty high degree of certainty on what your success is going to be. But it's really only one or two plays that you're running. And by the time you get to the hyper growth stage, you've got a full playbook. And you can kind of run situational plays depending on what gets thrown at you and like a whole range of different scenarios. So we'll talk about, I guess, what those look like. But to put it in layman's terms, it's kind of about product market fit, repeatability and scale, and hypergrowth.
Beautiful. And I can attest to Robbie being, he makes me feel like a small child when I stand next to him. I definitely didn't have the genetic makeup to be a basketball player. You can't tell it from here, but I'm no basketball player.
Great guitar player though.
I try. Product market fit stage comes first. What are we trying to achieve at this stage? You talked about a mismatch. Can you tell me a little bit more there?
Yeah. So, I think you don't want to get too fancy here. And I think if you're coming in a leadership position as like a head of sales or even like a first sales rep on the team, the goal needs to be survive. And I think that's a little bit of like a dire word to use, but I think in the reality of the world we work in today and in terms of, sales leadership and the timeline that you have to really like drive results, survival is key here. And the thing that you kind of want to think about even before you jump on board and take an opportunity is, where can you exploit sort of your advantages at this stage? Like, what are the advantages you have? Is it the product? Is it the size of your market? Is it sort of like the network that you might have as a result of like your investors? What are some of the things that you can lean on early on that you can use to drive wins? And that's kind of how I think about it as like a mismatch. It's not necessarily like an architected play where you can hire 20 people to do it over and over again. But with a small kind of tight-knit team of people who get it, you can exploit the mismatch and survive.
Basically, you're looking for a small gap in the market and you're trying to really like expand on that as much as possible.
Yeah, you got it. You're looking for a window. You're looking for a window. And I think you should kind of know going into, you know, taking a new opportunity, that window exists, and there should be some type of traction where you're already seeing that before, you know, coming on as like a head or a VP of sales. But that's what you look for at the product market fit stage.
Cool. And so talk to me, you said you got a small tight-knit team. What does that look like?
Yeah. So what I'm looking for here, and I've kind of learned this the hard way, where, you know, when you go pretty early, I think it's tempting to look at people who have sold into that specific industry and maybe over-index a little bit on, you know, domain experience. But I think the challenge is at that stage, domain experience is actually far less important than your ability to overcome like all the challenges that get thrown at you every day. And those challenges can be everything from, you know, your product and kind of where that is in its development cycle. Bigger buyers taking you seriously based on the size of your company, refining and using, you know, sales collateral that may not even exist yet. And so I think that the type of people that tend to do really well here are what I call utility players. So these are people who can play multiple positions. And these are your full cycle sales reps, the folks that don't need you to set them opportunities because they can go do it themselves. Reps that might do an SMB call at 9 a.m., a mid-market call at 11, and an enterprise on-site at 2 p.m., right, in the same day. I can kind of play and toggle between those different personas and personalities just because they've done it before. And this is obviously a very rare profile to find. And so hopefully when you're coming into this kind of a role, you've got a network or a Rolodex of, you know, people who trust you and people who want to go look for those mismatches with you and sort of find product market fit together. But I think at that stage, utility players are going to be the folks who can adapt and adjust the quickest and do what kind of the job demands at that stage.
And so in your eyes, it's more about the mindset of the reps as opposed to their specific background.
Yeah, I would say mindset, but also skill, like, and just kind of general ability. Like I think that, you know, I'm a lot more interested in somebody at this stage who has had success at this stage than I am in somebody who has sold a similar product to a similar buyer at a different stage, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So you're not one of those, I got to go, you know, find 10 reps that have been selling in the space that have Rolodexes that, you know.
Not yet. We'll get there when we get kind of into some of the later stages, but this is, you don't want to over-index on that this early. Like you want a team that, because the problem with these mismatches is that they're fickle, right? And that as soon as you sort of feel like you may be really taking advantage of one of these mismatches, it may turn out that you you overestimated how much of a mismatch that really was, and you need to make an adjustment and you need to drop when you play. And that's your job sort of as a leader. And so you need a team that can adjust and sort of give you that feedback in real time. And this should be happening on like a weekly, if not daily basis, right? And you're kind of trying to find these plays that are going to win. And it takes a certain kind of salesperson to be willing to deal with that type of adjustment day to day and be willing to not complain about, okay, now I have to go sort of prospect into a different buyer persona, or I need to go book my calendar full of meetings, just more kind of them understanding that that's part of the role at this stage.
Gotcha. And so you've got some full cycle reps. Do you have, like, is there anything backing them up? Any sales ops, like sales stack, sales tools, like who's doing all that?
Yeah. So, I mean, ideally you've got a couple SDRs, and I think I can kind of speak to my MixMax experience here. When I came in, we were at about 5 million in revenue, and it was pretty much all self-serve. So the product is, for folks that haven't used it before, you know, it's basically a Gmail plugin that gives you the ability to send sequences and templates and track your emails and do kind of a whole host of other things. And so my job coming in was to take that product more into enterprise kind of B2B buyers and sell team licenses. And so early on, you know, we hired a handful of utility player reps and we started to add in SDRs as well. But my job kind of as the head of sales did encompass a lot of sales ops and enablement. And that was kind of my evening job, I like to call it, where, you know, during the day it was being in deals and being on call, you know, with customers and doing everything we can to, you know, survive and win every day. And then the tinkering sort of within our CRM or sort of setting up our dashboards, or creating playbooks for new hires on their onboarding, all of that kind of came secondary. I think it's one of those things that's on your mind a lot when you're running a team is, man, this would be an amazing thing to delegate. And so you're interviewing and you're looking for these people, but you're also understanding that the most important thing is actually to get to this repeatability phase and have this repeatable process and have this repeatable play that you can run. And that's when sales ops and enablement actually like really becomes a lot more valuable. So you're kind of running this recruiting cycle in parallel, but understanding that like you have to show enough results really to earn it. And for me early on, I think that that's your job as the head of sales is to own ops and enablement. So for anybody who's thinking about jumping in as an early stage head of sales or first sales hire, I would get close to your sales ops person right now and learn how to run a couple reports and create some objects in Salesforce and how to at least know the basics so that you can kind of speak literally to your team on what the state of the business is. And you know, that help is coming soon, but you've got to kind of jump over and land on the other side first.
Right on. And yeah, the dashboards aren't going to be pretty and the reports aren't going to be built perfectly, but knowing how to do some of those base things so that you're not just playing with Salesforce straight out of the box and you're sort of hamstrung by not being able to customize it. So no sales ops yet. You are sort of that internal sales ops person. How many reps are we kind of talking at this stage?
Yeah, about 2 to 10. So I think, you know, you never want to have one rep because there's nobody to compete with. So you want to have at least two and hopefully try to hire in batches of at least two. So the folks kind of have a benchmark for performance, but also like, you know, somebody who they can really lean on during their ramp period to get questions answered. It just, you know, when you start to hire one person every couple months or something, your job becomes a lot harder. Try to hire in twos, but you're kind of going between 2 and 10 here. That's the number that you're looking at.
Cool. And they're all rolling up to that one head of sales at this stage.
Yeah. And I think you can, you may get like a line manager for the more junior reps on your team. Maybe you've built out SDR early on and you want to bring in like a leader or maybe promote like a team lead or something like that. Or you've got like an inside sales manager who can get involved with some of the more transactional kind of velocity deals. I think in general, like if you're in a position where you've got any kind of a hypothesis that you may be wanting to move up market and sell bigger deals, I think you want to, as a leader, be as close to that as possible and kind of have your hands on those deals. And so I think anytime you're thinking about putting that first layer of management in, you probably want to think about the area that's a little bit more like transactional and probably like low dollar value.
Gotcha. So you're focusing more on the sort of higher velocity number of higher velocity sales in those early days.
Yeah. And that's just in the context, if you're thinking about hiring a line manager, if you don't have one, then it's your job to focus on all of it. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. And so like, it seems like that's kind of a pitfall you can run into, which is like, All right, this is a really, really scalable process where you're selling sort of very low ACV, then you're going to need sort of a frontline person. But if it's more larger enterprise, you probably don't need the efficiency of that management structure. Can you talk to me about what some of the other pitfalls would be at this stage?
Yeah, I think you nailed two of them right there. And I think it depends on the type of profile that you're hiring for. Like if you're going after like a more junior rep, I think in general, like one of the biggest pitfalls early on is sales leaders kind of drowning in the one-on-ones and the sort of like general management of all of the reps directly reporting them, and just kind of getting over that hurdle in and of itself is a challenge. And so finding somebody, whether it's internally on your team or a leader that you're bringing in from the outside, like it really does change the dynamic significantly in those early days where you've got kind of these utility players in this core team and bringing in another leader. But you have to do it, and you really have to do it early on. And so I think that's one of the bigger things. Another pitfall. So I think one of the things I was fortunate to have been brought up in the world of sales development, where at Zenefits, I was put into a position to build and scale out a large SDR team from zero to 250 people. And Colin, as you know, serving a lot of customers in this space, sales development to me is a lot more of a science than it is an art. I think that the art in sales comes when you go a little bit more upmarket into more like enterprise motions where it's bigger deal values and more stakeholders and maybe even a little bit more emotion. It's a little bit more operational in the SDR piece of it. And so you really have to learn how to be like a strong ops leader and kind of get your sales ops chops pretty early. And you're building reports and dashboards, and that's just part of it. And I think that was something where I built that skill set early on in my career, and by no means am I great at it, but I'm good enough to be sufficient, I guess. And so I think I was able to get away with creating the sales op stuff myself. But I think for a head of sales that maybe doesn't have that background and comes maybe from somewhere where they index more on full cycle enterprise sales or mid-market or something like that, I would just think about filling that gap or that blind spot early on. And really putting yourself in a position to do the things that you're best at and focus on those things. So I would say that's another potential pitfall.
And I'll double down on that one. Like, it's, if you think about what a sales team, if you think about through the lens of the company, right, and what it's costing on the balance sheet, there's so many companies that unintentionally are penny wise and pound foolish, where you're happy spending a few hundred thousand dollars a year, you know, on a small sales team, but you won't spend, or they refuse to spend, you know, $10,000 or $20,000 investing in Salesforce to make sure that all the processes are buttoned down. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like you've bought this really expensive Formula One car and you've invested a ton of money in buying the car and you're like, great, I don't need a pit team. I just, you know, I bought the car, it should run. It's like, well, no, you need somebody to set it up. You need somebody to maintain it. You need somebody throughout the race. You need a whole crew of people. And maybe you don't need a whole crew of people for one driver. You don't need like 30 support people for one account exec, but sort of a similar analogy in that you've made this huge investment, spend a little bit of money to make sure that you're getting the most out of that. And that's investing in the right tools, the right sales ops. Do you see, I mean, maybe not the companies you work with, but maybe some that you've consulted with or bumped into, do you see people sort of see leaders or entrepreneurs pushing back on investments in tools in the sales ops budgets?
Yeah, I think that it's sales ops is becoming just like, I think SDR now sort of has a seat at the table, and your good friend like Aaron Ross, I think, was one of the people who was in the early days probably fighting really hard for budget, I would have to think, in sort of early days in Salesforce when this SDR team is getting created, and now that same playbook is being run kind of across the whole SaaS landscape and even beyond it. I think sales ops is like a year or two almost behind that in a way. But like revenue ops, sales ops, marketing ops in a way, kind of whatever you want to call that overarching sort of engine in the background. I think that like sometimes early stage founders that don't have as much exposure into sales teams and highly functional sales teams, for whatever reason, like maybe underinvest in that. But I think that that's something that, you know, when you're coming on board into an opportunity, that's an important thing to negotiate is, you know, what kind of opportunity am I going to have as a leader to invest in sales ops here? Knowing that, you know, every day that you wait, every deal you close, every rep that you hire, the risk of not having a good sales ops motion in the background compounds. Every time you're running payroll and commissions and there's not somebody else who's owning that and doing it the right way, you kind of get stuck back in this kind of mud of like general management and having to deal with sort of a lot of those, a lot of the repercussions of not getting it right the first time. So just like know your limitations and negotiate upfront what kind of resources you're going to be able to get and make it pretty clear what your priorities are. And I would recommend to anybody thinking about coming in at a product market fit stage that sales ops be one of those resources.
Right on. And you kind of alluded to it in your answer there, but making sure that you're not getting stuck in that sort of, not, I don't want to say lower level, but in the more front line of like closing and helping the team with closing. There's like the, I think it's a book called The E-Myth Revisited. And I don't know them off the top of my head, but there's basically, they talk about three levels of work. There's the sort of doer, there's the manager, and there's the strategic. And I find it for myself in the early days when we were kind of in this product market fit stage, it was so easy to get pulled into the doer. Right? Like I grew up as a salesperson. I spent 10 years as an account exec, closer, whatever you want to call them, in that role. And I helped stand up a couple of teams, but nothing where we got to the size of 250 reps. But I remember my first kind of opportunity at a SaaS company. And it was so easy to get pulled back into that doer, right? Mm. And then finally got out of the doer. And then I just got stuck in that sort of manager level, like you talked about, one-on-ones, like just stuck in the one-on-ones and stuck at the dashboards and stuck in the sales ops piece. Right. How do you remind yourself to pull out and say, okay, I got to focus on the higher level strategic pieces here?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I would do every week that I was taught my my good friend and a mentor of mine and my former boss, Sam Blonde, who's the VP of Sales at Zenefits, used to kind of talk to me about how at the end of the week, he would look at his calendar and just sort of do a quick review on like, where did I spend my time this week? Like bucket by bucket, what were the meetings I ran? What were the gaps in time and how did I spend it? And by doing like an audit every week of your calendar, you're able to pretty quickly keep yourself accountable for the things that you're actually spending your time on and prioritizing. And if you keep like a pretty diligent calendar on, you know, when is my downtime? What am I working on those in that downtime? That sort of thing, you can kind of get a sense. So the first thing is just to be aware of it and just be like very objective about the way you spend your time and open and honest about it. And that way you can actually start to like make changes if you need to. That's one of the things I recommend is doing like a weekly calendar audit, at least a monthly kind of review on how you're spending your time, especially if you're in like a busy early stage product market fit environment where you're kind of getting pulled in every different direction. You're probably meeting with the product team periodically. You're doing a lot of things you maybe wouldn't do in the future. And then from there, like, I think you have to be pretty honest with yourself about what are the things that you do that don't feel like work, that to everybody else feel like work. Another way to ask that is, what are your superpowers, right? What are the things you love to do? And I think for a lot of heads of sales, that's like being involved with deals and being involved with the right deals, right, at the right stage. And so I think it actually is important to be involved in sort of like the minutia for certain things, but do it for the stuff where you have the highest leverage, right? And you can make the biggest impact, whether that's later stage deals, of course, hiring, you know, all the sort of things that are going to make the biggest impact today as well as tomorrow. And then be really honest with yourself about those other things. And you don't really need to advertise or complain about it. Like, just do the work in the background to start to backfill and get people into roles where they can kind of own those things, you know, and the other part of that is letting go, right? And being willing to let go of the things that, you know, you're doing day to day and really understand like what are the one to two things that you can do that'll have the highest impact on the business, and then be pretty relentless about filling the rest of that into people who can do it better.
100%. Because at the end of the day, like you said, you don't want to get stuck in this stage, and it's so easy to get stuck in these habits. So when you're thinking about getting ready for that next stage, what are the things that you need to nail in order to make it to that repeatability and scale?
Yeah, for sure. So I recall back early on at Zenefits, we had built out like, we sort of tested this theory on build. We were an all inbound shop for a while, and we tested this theory on outbound because the deal sizes were just sort of like hitting a certain level where we needed to go above that, and we weren't really able to generate it with our traditional marketing techniques. So we tested this outbound team out, and I was running that test, and it was really working early on. And this was a very condensed timeline. We're talking about months instead of quarters or years here.
Was this when Parker, when you were sending all the emails in Parker's name?
That was more our inbound play. So the outbound play was like a little bit different than that. But the infamous play. So on outbound, it was much more sort of targeted LinkedIn, direct messaging, kind of the why you now type of technique. Basically, the idea was, okay, if we can get, you know, reasonably get, and we kind of did the math on it, if we can get our reps to about 24 opportunities a month, and those were of a certain deal size, and we could close kind of X number of those deals, then we would be in good shape. This would be a profitable role for the business, and we would be able to kind of scale the sales team even more. And we figured out pretty quickly we could do that. And so the way we did that was we developed a couple different plays. We ran them consistently, and we were able to predict our win rates. And I think kind of at each level, that's what you need to do is develop the play, be able to run it consistently and actually measure it, and do it to the point where you can actually predict your win rates plus or minus 5%. And once you can do that, you've got not like a hypothesis, but you've actually got something that's going to work. And that's the point where you can ask for that extra headcount or that extra budget and start to put that theory to the test a little bit more aggressively and move into this next stage, which is repeatability and scale.
And so It's basically, I love your first step there, which is make sure it's going to be profitable. Do some basic spreadsheeting. Make sure you're going to make money off of this. I need this many ops. I need this much of a close rate. Build a playbook that's going to enable it, and then test to see if that's actually producing the consistent results that you're hoping for. Yeah. And then I imagine there's sort of a loop. If you're not hitting it, okay, go look for bottlenecks, and then, you know, go back. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. And then once you've nailed it, now we're talking, okay, we're at the repeatability and scale. We're asking for more headcount. What's the goal at this repeatability stage?
Yeah. So the goal is to demonstrate predictability. And this is something that you guys know a lot about, obviously, and I'm sure you can speak to. But I think one of the hardest things to do in any type of early stage sales environment is predict things correctly, right? And we kind of live in this world that's completely unpredictable, and it's our job to keep our head on straight. And then when nobody's looking, like, be constantly in the background hedging every single type of thing that could possibly go wrong, so that you've got you've got yourself covered, right? But really, at the repeatability and scale stage, it's about how do we get from just being able to sort of take advantage of this mismatch to how can we actually run this play consistently and kind of plus or minus 5%, like, be able to know what our win rates are going to be so that we can demonstrate predictability. And what that does is it does a lot of things for the business, right? Like, if you're at a growth stage company, it gives your founders like a story that they can go tell to investors and actually show data behind it and show kind of quarter over quarter results that says, like, this is, you know, these are the plays that we run. This is how well they work. And if we sort of, our hypothesis, if we're able to pour this much money into it, this is the return we can get on it. And so this unlocks just like a lot of different things for the business. But at this stage, the focus to me is around demonstrating predictability.
And would you say this is pre or post Series A raise typically?
I mean, if you're at a predictable sales motion pre Series A, God bless you. Like, you're in a great spot. Hopefully you're vested at this point. Hopefully you're home shopping. I don't know. Like, it's, you're in a really good spot if you're doing that. I think it's probably closer to somewhere between Series B, Series C, at least nowadays, given that like folks are, raising A's earlier and earlier, in the process. But yeah, I think, you know, repeatability, like, to be clear, I think that these stages can span for every business. They're going to be different, and they're going to be different based on a number of factors. And I think, like, if you have a very, short feedback loop on your sales cycles, meaning like a more transactional sales cycle, you're going to be able to put hypotheses to the test and plays to the test quicker and get sort of feedback on how repeatable or predictable those plays are. And you're going to be able to figure those things out sooner. If you're selling a 12-month sales cycle, it's going to be different. You need to be sort of really diligent about seeing these plays all the way through the finish line. So I don't necessarily think that these are tied to any specific like fundraising round, but I think generally speaking, like Series B or Series C is about the time repeatability becomes the focus.
That's fair. And I wasn't trying to infer that, you know, you've got to be at a certain stage, or, I mean, obviously it takes time and cash to have this number of people. This would be fairly challenging to do on a seed stage or bootstrap budget, you know, in a short period of time.
Definitely. But anybody out there who's doing that, again, I commend you. That's awesome.
Yeah. If you're listening, you're like, hey, I'm that guy. Email me. I want you to come on the podcast. You're yes. Our next guest.
Yes.
All right. So basically the goal here with the repeatability and scale is to demonstrate predictability. Mm-hmm. So what does the team look like at this stage?
Yeah. So I think now is when you start to kind of pick a strategy, right? Like, you've probably got some type of sales methodology that you're that's sort of percolating through the organization, where everybody is running their discoveries in a similar way, and customers are kind of going through the journey and in like a similar type of fashion, and your buyers have the same experience, hopefully, when they buy from you. And you're probably segmenting out your sales process. And so what I mean by that is you've got prospectors prospecting, you've got closers closing, and you've got, you know, account managers managing. And so whether it's SDR, AE, CSM, there's this kind of clear, hopefully well-oiled handoffs that are happening in the sales cycle, so that you can drill into each of those different parts of the sales process and like drive improvement and iteration faster, and create a little bit more control over your sales process. So for one, it's segmented. And then your accounts are probably segmented as well, based on and routed based on, you know, size of the account, geo, or some other type of criteria that you're using to give the accounts that you were bringing in to work to the people that you feel have the highest chance of closing and create like the best customer experience along the way.
Love it. So we're developing that specialization. We're not just around the sort of internal sales process, but it's also around the how we're looking at and treating our customers.
Yeah, because you're building out your playbook, right? Like you're running hopefully more than one play at one time here. So you're going to need different people to kind of handle the motion for those different plays. And you're building those teams out in unison. But you know, the group is still tight knit enough where everybody can probably fit into the same conference room for like the weekly sales meeting. And so the feedback loops are still really tight here. But you are kind of scaling out in a number of different directions at the same time.
So that's fair. So you're adding a ton of different roles. What is the sales enablement or sales ops process? Like how does that evolve from you doing it off the side of your desk to where we're at today?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, hopefully during that product market fit stage, you had been, you know, quietly recruiting your number one sales ops prospect because now's the time to do it. And I think the sales ops hire comes first. There is, you know, it's the type of thing where you've probably got so many different things you need to hand off. You actually only have to, you can only pick a portion of them to hand over to this person in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Like it should be almost painfully obvious what this person's going to be doing. So you would, in my opinion, you'd bring in a sales ops leader first, hopefully somebody who has got, you know, hopefully like a director level experience, at least in my opinion, is kind of like what you look for, like bringing in the big company VP, from, you know, IBM or something like that. That person's probably not going to add a ton of value here. You still need a certain level of scrappiness and utility, in this person. And so finding somebody who is like a proven leader, but is also still kind of adaptable and willing to roll up their sleeves, kind of a canned answer, but it is what you look for. And I think pretty quickly after that, you're looking for somebody in enablement. And the reason why is because demonstrating predictability requires a couple things. One of those is measurement and sort of measurement of every aspect of the sales process and understanding like where your pitfalls are before they become pitfalls. Sales ops can help you do that and own it. The other part is ramping your reps. And leveling up the reps you've already got on your team. And that's where somebody who's great at enablement can really step in and do it. And hopefully you've got a leadership team underneath you already that embody some of these qualities, especially around enablement. But you want to bring a professional in pretty quickly after getting that sales ops hire who's going to help own, you know, the successful skill development and execution during the ramp period for all these new reps you're bringing.
Beautiful, because it's not just about sales enablement, isn't just about stitching together all the tools. It's about making sure that you're ramping and onboarding all these reps. Because at this stage, you know, how many reps are we talking, or how many, like what's the sort of team size we're talking about here?
Yeah, so we're going from about 10 to 30, I would say at this stage, 10 to 25, about that range. So again, you've got a couple different, your process is segmented. So you've got closers, prospectors, and post sales. And you've likely got your customers segmented out either by size or geo. And so in doing that, you've probably got somewhere between 10 and 25 reps in your team.
Gotcha. And so I imagine not only are you getting more strategic about how you're ramping people up, I imagine the hiring, like to go from, you know, 10 to 30, that's not something that you can do overnight. So how does your hiring change? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, so this is a really good question. And this was something that at Flexport, we experienced this evolution and I think did a pretty good job working through it. And I think the challenge at Flexport was that we were all like the hiring growth. We had this big question as to whether we were going to centralize our SDR function and sort of have everybody under one roof or decentralize it and have, the SDRs that supported those markets in those local markets, because we were opening up new offices all over the world pretty quickly. When I joined, we had about 3 global offices and then we grew to like 9 in a year. And so all of those had their own local GM, they had their own P&L, they had their own sales team, they had their own goals. And we ended up deciding to decentralize it, and that was the right decision. The reason why is because each of these markets, you know, an SDR's job in Hong Kong is going to look very different than an SDR's job in Amsterdam. But before we started to scale that out, we really zeroed in on the profile that we wanted to hire for that role specifically. And if you can really zero in on that profile that you want so that your recruiters can predictably source that profile and that person, similar to your sales process, going out and sourcing similar looking deals, then you're in good shape. Excuse me. And you kind of want to think about your hiring process a little bit like your sales motion here, only kind of like a step behind. Once you're already at this repeatability phase for your sales motion, you're trying to go from product market fit to repeatability on your hiring motion. And you kind of have to let this expectation of like, I'm only going to hire these sort of all-encompassing utility players that can do anything at any moment. You have to let that dissolve away. Likely because those people are kind of bored at this stage and aren't going to stay around that much longer. Just to be completely honest, like for that type of profile, hopefully they do. Or maybe they're in leadership positions or focusing on different things in the business. And so now you want to zoom in on what that specific profile looks like and make it easier for your recruiting team, whether it's like an outside recruiting support or you have an internal team that you're starting to build, make it easy for them to find that profile for you.
Gotcha. So it sounds like a huge step up in terms of the hiring process and how diligent you're going to be. With that, I'm curious because as you add more and more people, you add more and more complexity. So there's so many more areas for things to sort of fall off the rails. What do you see are some of the major pitfalls when you get to this stage or when you're kind of in the middle of making the journey towards the 30 reps?
I would say hiring too fast. You know, I learned that the hard way. I would say Zenefits. We went from 5 to 30 reps in 60 days. And you know, that was a very compressed timeline. We did a good job hiring great people. And most of those people in that first, you know, 30 folks went on to be the future leaders of the business and the organization, but it wasn't all perfect. And you know, I think that hiring too fast and sort of, you know, that can come from a number of different pressure points. Maybe you've got a huge number that you signed up for in a year and that's contingent on hiring a lot of new reps. Maybe you've got pressure from the board after raising a big round of funding and you need to go out and hire a bunch of people, but I think it's your job as a leader to understand and really keep a close eye on if I'm going to hire somebody new, like if I just look at the last 2 or 3 people I hired, like how are they performing? What was their experience in the first 90 days? Like, and what do we need to do to improve upon that the next time around? And I think having that feedback loop happen after almost every single hire is important. And so hiring too fast, that's a big one. And that can be a culture killer. You know, it can. So you gotta be careful there. And then I would say the other thing is probably over-indexing on one specific play. So, you know, example, that would be like, you know, the market size for one customer profile. Like if we can, you know, maybe we're doing a great job selling into, mid-market recruiting teams at SaaS companies, you know, okay, there are a bunch of them out there and, you know, it's an endless blue sea when you're in the product market stage, but now you've got 15 reps, right? They've mapped this out. All these accounts are in Salesforce and they've got a long list of activity underneath. Like, what are you going to do now? And so I think you need to be sort of constantly having that conversation about like, what other hypotheses are we testing? What other markets are we trying to break into? What other plays are we running on the side to start to think about, you know, where else we can grow and directionally run and generate predictable wins. So I think the other pitfall there is over-indexing on one specific play.
Gotcha. Because I think on the flip side, what you're looking for is not to be overly reliant on just one single market, one target customer, one persona, because then it's basically you've ran out of blue ocean and now it's all right. Now we need to either move on to the next one or find a way to get a lot more efficient at, you know, if there are only 200 companies that you can work with, okay, well, how do we move into a more like named account, targeted account sort of style so that we can boost our conversion rates? Whereas if you do have the opportunity to go a little bit wider and say, okay, let's try opening up a new market, then that's one of the things that you're recommending.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, exactly. And I think sales ops can really help here. So like mapping out your market and sort of understanding like what the total addressable market is and looking at that just like that kind of from like a raw data lens and understanding like where you can go, that really helps put into context like what your growth numbers should look like and kind of what number you should be signing up for and expecting your team to hit. And that's kind of the beginning of when you start to really map out that market, like that's the beginning of really nailing this like predictability portion of it because you understand every sort of piece on the table. And it's just kind of about execution at that point.
Right on. And so if we could sum up the sort of the goal at the repeatability and stage is sort of demonstrate predictability, the way that you're doing that is not just nailing your ideal customer profile, but all the other optional segments. The way you can do that is, you know, employing sales ops and sales enablement so that we've got not just the data behind it, but we're also the tools and the training. You're ramping up your hiring and making sure that you're sort of moving more towards the specialization. And then that's sort of the combination of all of those things is really what's driving that predictability.
It's that easy. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of stuff, but yeah, that's it, right? It's you're running a lot of plays at once. And I think just kind of hearing you go over that checklist, I think should, like, to any listener, should probably tell you, man, I'm going to need some support here. And so I think, like, you know, again, it's been said a million times, but like focusing on recruiting and hiring the very best people you possibly can just relieves pressure off so many of these different things. That if you can sort of focus on any one thing to help increase your odds of success at this level, you know, hiring and continuing to find great people across all these different segments and parts of the business we discussed is that's the highest leverage activity I think that you've got.
Perfect. And so once you've nailed those, just hitting your numbers, like what do you need to do to get to that next stage?
Yeah. So I don't think it's actually about just hitting your numbers. I think you really have to like crush the number that's been given to you to earn that trust. And I think that you can kind of look at that in a couple of different lenses, but you have to basically by demonstrating this predictability and repeat at the repeatability stage, you should be able to pretty accurately predict your number. And that gives you as a leader and your team confidence when you're able to start like zeroing in on a target and clipping it down, you know, plus or minus 5% and doing it every month, every quarter. And really like digging deep and like crushing your number gives your team, your board, your leadership, your executives, the confidence to double down, right? And really like accelerate and pour fuel onto the fire and kind of see what you can do. And so I think like, you know, really it's about crushing your numbers and hopefully what you've been doing in the background as you've been building out this team is you've been developing a playbook, right? You've been developing multiple plays now that you can predict success with. And because you want to be hedged, right? Like you need to hedge these bets. And if you're putting all your eggs into one basket, like it's you know, it can work, but it probably won't. And so hopefully you've got a really great leadership team that you trust around you. And you've got an opportunity for each of them to sort of pursue some of these different plays and have budget to kind of go after those things. And that's when you're ready to think about, okay, let's make this jump to hypergrowth.
So when we're jumping, we've got roughly about 30 reps. We've got our playbooks nailed. Our hiring process is pretty thought through. We've got pretty strong sales ops. We've probably, it sounds like you've built a couple leaders underneath you if you're sort of the VP of sales or you're kind of transitioning into a role similar to that. So what is the next, what does this hypergrowth stage look like?
Yeah, so I've been fortunate to jump to this part of the journey twice, once at Zenefits and then again at Flexport. And at Zenefits, I kind of saw it from, you know, the first stage really, product market fit all the way through it. And then at Flexport, I had the pleasure of arriving at the repeatability stage where there was a little bit more guaranteed and then kind of growing with the business more into this hypergrowth stage. And, you know, if you've arrived here, like great job. Like if you're evolving from repeatability to hypergrowth, like that's a win for you, on your resume and in terms of like your career and what you've probably learned along the way. So you should feel really good about that just to kind of pause and acknowledge that. And yeah, I mean, getting to this stage, the goal really becomes win your market. Right. And you have to figure out, okay, what is that market exactly? But at this point, you are, you know, one of probably two or three in your space that are, you know, likely to win. And now the goal is to go win it. And I think it becomes a lot more about execution at this stage. And so, yeah, I think win your market is kind of the tagline I would use for hypergrowth.
Gotcha. So we're kind of we're recording August 1st, 2019. Would you say a fair comparison in the sales space would be the sort of sales loft outreach kind of battle that's going on? I don't know if they're in a battle or if they're friendly with each other, but they're sort of at similar stages. They've both raised, you know, 100 million plus, maybe 200 million in the case of outreach, right? Is this sort of the stage where they're at this sort of hyper growth? You got to win the market.
I think that's a fair comparison. And I think like, you know, you could say that maybe right behind them, maybe like 6 months behind them is like your gong and chorus, right? where you, it's pretty clear everybody in the market who's shopping for those products at this stage is looking at 2 to 3 competitors, right? They know who those folks are, which means you've probably got a pretty strong inbound engine and your deals are competitive. And you know who your competitors are, right? And you need to do a pretty good job making sure your customers love you at this stage, and you invest a lot more in kind of post sales and those renewals. Cause you know, on that journey from product market fit to repeatability, you've got a bunch of great logos, right? Ideally underneath you. And so you want to make sure you've got a good team handling that. But I think your comparison there, yeah, I think that's a fair comparison.
And I think you're totally right. And it's not just about like winning the market is not just about closing the largest number of customers. Even though this is kind of a sales podcast, that's kind of where we're focused, but the mathematics dictates you need to have happy customers, right? So if we want to build a solid revenue stream, you can't have 5%, 10% monthly churn, right? That's not an indication of a healthy business.
100%. I think churn is a top 2 or 3 risk at hypergrowth. If you've got a leaky bucket at this stage, you've never poured as much into that bucket as you're about to pour into it, and you'll be exposed if that's what ends up happening.
Mm-hmm. We had a customer in the early days, and I was looking for examples, for companies of each of these, and I'm like, I found a bunch of good ones, but you know, some of them were great stories. Some of them were stories that didn't make people look great. And I didn't want to be blown up, you know, customers or people I knew on the podcast, you know, with their failures. This one here is sort of well documented. Their founder, early sales, it was an early sales leader sort of wrote a post about it, but these guys jumped from, you know, they thought they were at repeatability and scale and they were jumping into hypergrowth. And I want to say they had 10, 20, 30 reps, I think, in there. And it was probably 15, you know, SDRs and 15 AEs, something along those lines. This was like 3 or 4 years ago. So I apologize if my memory is failing me a little bit. But the company's called 2020. And it was Micah Cohen. He wrote a blog post about all the things that they did. And what happened is they actually missed that first thing that you mentioned at when we got to, I think it was the product market. No, I think it was when you got to the repeatability and scale stage, which is, product market fit, make sure this is going to be profitable, right? In order to get to the next stage. And what they did is they skipped that. They went into repeatability and scale and they scaled up a huge SDR team. They spent a couple $1 million and they generated a very small amount of revenue. And a lot of the revenue, I would say, churned away. But they were spending, you know, $5 to close $1 of ARR. It's like, whoa. Like I follow David Scox from David Scox metrics the blog is forentrepreneurs.com. If you just look at, you know, SaaS metrics, he does a great analysis of the Pacific Crest survey every year. I think it's a different company now. It's the same people, but it's called something different now. But I've watched that since 2013 when he started, and it's climbed from like people spending 90 cents to acquire $1 of annual recurring revenue to last time I checked, it was like $1.10, $1.12 to acquire $1 of ARR. And so in those cases, like in this case, he was $5 to acquire $1, which obviously isn't going to make sense.
Yeah.
But like it was just an example of somebody moving all the way through all of these steps to get to what they thought was hypergrowth. And as they were starting to accelerate, they're bleeding cash to the point where they're like, wait a minute, our revenue is dropping because customers are turning away because our sales team is pushing so hard. We're not closing the right customers.
Yeah. And that is not a super uncommon story. It's pretty common that like you know, there's a lot of companies at these stages that would pay $1.50 for $1 in revenue, especially if it's recurring, right? If it's SaaS revenue, you know, it'll take 2 years to pay that back or a year and a half, depending on how you look at it, right? So I'm not gonna sit here and say that's the wrong approach. But I think that you have to be aware of it at the very least. So if it starts to get into sort of danger zone territory, like the example you gave, it's not a surprise. And, I see this a lot, I think, especially with SDR teams. There is sort of a fundamental, in some cases, lack of trust with sales and marketing on early stage companies because both teams are getting built from scratch and they're trying to show results and they're being scrappy. And it's, you know, it's hard to necessarily stay exactly in unison. So SDR teams are often like a great way to fill that gap, and teams invest in those and then, you know, sort of figure out 3 years down the line in some cases, wow, this isn't as profitable as we thought it was going to be. In fact, this is like a loss leader for us. And that's actually what I'm focused on today with Buena Vista Ventures is I help early stage teams build out their sales teams, basically from SDR to AE to kind of, you know, everything that goes into that, and get the right metrics and numbers in place early on so that you know exactly what that looks like. But I think you're absolutely right that that is something you need to be tuned into early on.
100%. Because if it's not profitable, like spending $5 to acquire a dollar, like unless you have a massive amount of money in the bank, it's going to take a while to recover that capital unless there's huge upsell potential. But I'll step down off my soapbox. So when we're talking about winning the market, what does your team look like at this stage?
Yeah, you've probably got at least two layers of leadership underneath like your head of sales here. And I'm looking at this through kind of a head of sales lens, but you can choose to kind of apply this to a number of different positions. You've probably got a director and sort of a manager team underneath that. And you know, those different teams are serving those different types of plays that you're running or those different types of customers. And you're likely spread out across multiple geos. So if you're based in the SF Bay Area, like you're not hyper growing likely just in downtown San Francisco. That doesn't really happen a whole lot anymore. So, you know, maybe you've got a secondary team in Salt Lake City or Phoenix or sort of anywhere else in the continental US. Maybe you've got a big market in Europe and you've gone out and you've opened up an office out there. But your scope now as a leader of this organization is spanning across multiple geos.
Gotcha. And so just anecdotally, Salt Lake and Phoenix, two places I've heard a ton of people spinning up offices in Salt Lake and Phoenix. Why these two locations?
Well, I mean, I think it's easy to say like lower cost market, like as like a place to start. But I actually think that like you go where the talent is, right? Like you go to find people, and it totally depends on the type of person you're trying to hire into these roles. But let's take a common example of somebody who is like a more junior sales rep, you know, two to four years of experience or something like that. You're going to go to places that have a high concentration of college graduates that move there. So somewhere like Chicago, right? Like they're doing a really good job pulling in people from like the Big 12 who go to colleges around there and you know, want to start their career, but would also want to live in a city where there's a lot of stuff to do and there's stuff going on. So you look for places like that. Raleigh, North Carolina is another great place that they're doing that. I think Pendo is based out there. There's a bunch of companies in Raleigh. So you go where the talent is. And I remember for Zenefits, when we were going through this exercise, thinking about where we can open up our next office, we had about 25 or 30 reps on our team. We're making this jump from repeatability to hyper growth. And the things that we looked at were proximity to HQ. So it was about a, you know, 65 minute flight or so, something like that, 90 minutes maybe. Make it easy for executive team to make day trips. Obviously the kind of cost of living and kind of cost to hire out there was a big one. The ability to scale. So how quickly could we go find like a new office space if we outgrew this one or the one after that? And you know, there's a lot of space in Phoenix, and really more than anything, that was the talent. And the nice thing about Phoenix was that there was just a lot of people would move there after they graduated from university, and we had a good opportunity to hire a lot of really talented people out there really quickly. So I think that those are kind of some of the reasons that people like Salt Lake and Phoenix.
Right on. It's because you hear the, you know, I'm up here in Vancouver, and I get to interact with a ton of our guests, and I try and stay in touch with a bunch of them. And I've been hearing the myth of the six-figure SDR a lot lately, which is like, when I think about the mathematics, I'm just like, the fundamentals of, does it make sense to have SDRs? Yeah. The math gets really hard if you're spending 600, you know, or 100 grand a year on an SDR.
Well, I mean, I think in some of these cities, you know, in San Francisco, 100 grand is just, you're starting to flirt with cost of living, you know, at that. So I think it's market forces probably more than anything. And that's where you adapt. But that is a big number for sure.
It certainly must be one of those pressures that's pushing hiring outside of the Bay Area.
Yeah, the Bay Area, New York, London, a lot of different places. I've got a client in London right now, and you know, it's the same story. You know, the cost of living is kind of just as high there. And so salaries do have an impact, but you know, you look for people, I think, in some of these earlier roles that are in it for more than the money and sort of can see the long-term benefit of sort of proving themselves in that role and learning the skills and then sort of understanding when the earning is going to really come in your career and understanding that you're not going to maximize the income in the first year, right? It's going to be the years that compound after that.
Man, I remember being that early hire in sales thinking I should be making six figures this year. Like I'm fresh. I got my bachelor's, or I got 98% of my bachelor's, I should be making six figures.
Right.
Because
right.
why not? You know? So from a team perspective, we got a couple layers. You're spread out across multiple geos, not just in terms of, and perhaps even internationally. So not just in terms of the customer segments that you're going after, but the physical locations of your office. And yep. obviously going international, are you we can handle this from head office, or are you more of a build the office, hire somebody local to run it kind of?
I'm more build the office and hire somebody locally to run it. I think, you know, I was really fortunate to work at a place, Flexport, that did this phenomenally. They built this business model where they built these things called squads, and the squads kind of grew organically. And when the squad sort of had, it was like basically a book of business that had ops support, sales support, and sort of like, you know, a team around it. And as soon as that team got too big, it split like a cell and became two squads. And that model permeated through all the offices that Flexport went on to open. And an important part of that, of course, is hiring, is getting sort of a leader in place. But I think what Flexport did really well was generate a lot of those leaders in sort of like a homegrown way, where, you know, the first couple of folks that went out and opened and seeded new offices were from that local SF office. And that actually starts to become a pretty cool perk if you sell it the right way from a recruiting perspective, is getting to go open up a new office in a different market and let your job take you to a new place in the world. So, you know, hopefully you can find somebody internally who can bring that culture out there. I think at the very least, try to send a couple of your high performers to that new market so they can sort of seed it and spread that culture. I was that person at Zenefits way back in the day and moved out to Scottsdale after saying no the first time and ended up going, and it was a great decision for me. So, you know, you look for those kind of people.
Beautiful. And I imagine as you're scaling up the team, you've got multiple layers, multiple geos.
Yeah.
The sales operations burden must just be phenomenal at this day. I shouldn't call it a burden, but like the requirement for the glue to help everything continue working together has just got to be a phenomenal investment.
Yeah. So the way I think about this is the value of sales ops and enablement, it scales concurrently with the business. So the more the bigger the goals, the more people you have on the team, the more valuable and high impact sales ops and enablement can become. Whereas like in the early days, it isn't really necessarily that high of an impact. And so, you know, the ability to spot problems before they become big and successfully ramp reps and level up the existing team that you have really becomes a huge part of your continued success and execution. And I distinctly remember at Zenefits, our sales team meetings evolving from somewhat sporadic, like, you know, let's get everybody's commits, what's closing this week, what do we need to do to get that deal over the line type of meetings, to more sort of leadership meetings that were led by sales ops and led by data, where we would drill into these like big, beautiful reports. And my eyes were open to a whole new style of management that I had never seen before. And man, it was a beautiful thing. And they bought, you know, we brought a lot of professional sales ops folks in that did a great job spotting these things, and we would drill into it and we would lead with data in every conversation. And that was a big learning for me. And I think that that's something that sales ops can help you do and help become like a part of the fiber and the core of your organization.
Can you give me an example of a type of problem that you ran into that sales ops was able to sort of surface by, you know, showing you the data?
Sure. You know, I think when you're getting up to a number like 200 sales reps or something like that, a couple things start to happen. One of the first things is it becomes a little bit harder to spot personnel problems. And that can be anything from performance to something that's a little bit more qualitative. And sales ops like make sure that like any kind of quantitative gaps in terms of like performance don't get missed. And that gets spotted very, very quickly. And so if there was sort of like consistent underperformance in some type of an area, like that would be discovered right away. And you probably think, well, that's, you know, the manager's job to do that. Sure. But looking at it from a lens of like a couple hundred reps, that starts to be the case. And then I remember at Flexport, you know, one of the things that we had happen early on that was, you know, a little bit concerning was some of the customers that we were going out and sourcing, the demos that we were sourcing, just weren't closing. And I think that what we figured out is we didn't really understand our target, like the buyer profile that was the highest likelihood to close well enough. So we really dug deep into historic data and looked at every customer that ever closed of all time. And we were able to drill into what was the average title of that person? What was the average tenure of that person? Where did they live, like relative to like a city or like outside of a city? And go like very, very deep on like kind of like almost like a LinkedIn, like kind of individual search of who that buyer is to what is that business look like. We made those adjustments. We started to go after, you know, that type of business, and it worked, right? And I think like I wouldn't have gone and run that report. And I was too busy. I had too many interviews to do. You know, I was too busy doing all these other things. And so I think that's where you can get kind of big lifts in value from ops and enablement.
Right on. Because at this stage, like you mentioned, you were stuck in meetings or stuck in hiring. Like we've gone from 30 reps to 200 reps, and maybe not in every situation, but the hiring process must change phenomenally. I know at this stage, you know, let's say you've got some levels of leadership underneath you. You've got sales manager, sales director, VP of sales, maybe your VP or your CRO, or you're still the sort of head of sales at this stage. How involved are you in the hiring process, if at all?
I'm still super involved. And I think like too, I'm, you know, I'm still super involved in the hiring process. I still like, that was one thing that I pretty much made sure to always do, was always at least be in the interview process. When you start at Zenefits, it got to the point where we had, I was a director of SDR, and we hired a couple of other directors from the outside to come help support and split the team up and spread it out. And it was definitely the right thing to do. I was very fortunate to work with some great folks. I couldn't be in every interview at that point. And so that was kind of like a tough, you know, tough thing to let go. But, you know, at Mixmax and at Flexport, I was pretty much in every interview for every hire we made. And that was like, for me personally, that was the part of work that felt like play. I loved getting to know people. I loved understanding what their motivations were. I loved drilling in and understanding, like, is this really going to be a fit? And having those kind of like frank person-to-person conversations. And so I sort of understood that was the biggest area of impact that I could make. So I was in pretty much every interview I could be.
I feel like when I'm in a really, really strong interview, I feel it's so similar to a discovery call, right? To actually trying to close a customer, right? On both conversations, you're just looking for a fit. There might be a slightly different set of qualification questions that you're asking on either side, but I didn't expect to like hiring as much as I have. I thought, oh, it's going to be this big burden. It's sort of the thing that HR takes care of. But I'm on your side. I actually quite enjoy the hiring process.
Yeah. I think one of the things you have to be careful of, and I think the analogy you drew is pretty accurate, like in terms of that being sort of a discovery process, but you have to be careful not to have a bias for a certain kind of outcome. Whereas in sales, you obviously have a bias for a certain kind of outcome, right? That's a win. And you know, if you're the hiring manager, certainly you want to make the hire. You're in the interview room for a reason. There's an open rec, and you want to find the right person. But I think you have to be a little bit more willing to let the situation play out organically, and then sort of like take a minute and look at it objectively, rather than necessarily coming with an agenda. But I do think that the sort of mechanism by which you lead the conversation, ask open-ended questions, and sort of try to drive an outcome, basically, is similar to a discovery call. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess you can't come in with this, you know, I've got to hit a target of, you know, X people, because, you know, on the downside with selling the wrong customer is you're selling some churn, which, you know, it's just one customer, it's extra load on the team. The downside of hiring a bad rep is a ton of missed opportunities. It's almost like 10x worse, right? Because they're going to, you know, if you miss 10 customers, right, it's the equivalent of churning, you know, prematurely churning 10. So the stakes are quite a bit higher. So,
yeah, I agree.
So when we did the pre-interview, you said something counterintuitive at this stage. Since we were talking about hiring, you actually, you talked to me about your hiring theory on SDRs at this stage.
Yeah. So at the hypergrowth stage, I experienced really in a couple of, at both, I would say Zenefits and Flexport to a much lesser degree, but definitely Zenefits, like the sort of law of diminishing returns when it comes to sales development. And I think the reality is the returns kind of can only be as big as your market. And what I mean by that is, like, once you've got your sort of full market mapped out, and for us at Zenefits, it was any sort of small to medium sized business that offered health insurance benefits in the continental United States. Once we had that fully mapped out, and we did it pretty quickly, we had touched everybody. And it was sort of now we were going back, we were getting creative about how can we do sort of like, you know, closed lost re-engage plays, and how can we go like get back into this market with different messaging. But, you know, now you've got a team of 250 people. And they're not necessarily like increasing their performance month over month like they were for the last, you know, whatever, 18 months. And I actually think, and this is a little bit counterintuitive, I think you should slow down SDR hiring at the hypergrowth stage and focus a little bit more on feeding that talent pool into your inside sales team, and sort of try to slow down the hiring just directly for, you know, for folks that have maybe one or two more years of experience in your SDRs. Think about making a much more formalized program where you can pull that talent up directly. And there's some folks on your podcast who have done a phenomenal job of that. My buddy Stephen Brody did a great job of that at MuleSoft. And there's some other folks that really have put that kind of talent first mindset, and that's permeated through the organization. You've got SDRs that are closing enterprise deals at that company 4 years later. It's a beautiful thing. I think that becomes the focus a bit more. It's still a big engine for growth, but hopefully at the hypergrowth stage, you've got a really good marketing team that's supporting you along the way. And it's not, you really, I haven't seen any type of hypergrowth company that is a fully outbound play. I don't know that it necessarily works. I'd be interested to know if you have any companies in mind that have done that successfully, but I can't think of any. And so I think you want to slow down SDR hiring a bit here, in my opinion, and focus a little bit more on continuing to you know, generate more value out of every opportunity, go up market, do the things that you need to do to make the ROI of that hire continue to like go up, but focus on feeding that talent in your organization.
Yeah, I know I'm sitting on the side of the podcast that, you know, my co-founder wrote the book on outbound, but I think when you get to this stage, and I don't have an opinion on what sort of what channel is better in the early days. I know what I would do because of my unique skill set, right? Every other founder, every other early sales leader is going to be a lot different. Some are going to be stronger on the marketing side. Some are going to be stronger on the product side. Some are going to be stronger on the outbound side. To me, it doesn't really matter. When you get into the hypergrowth stage, it's not about inbound or outbound. It's stacking channels, right? It's whatever channel I can use to reach my target market is what I'm going to employ. Because no matter what you're going to do, you're going to start to see diminishing returns. At Zenefits, you had a wide open market, right? This is about as wide of market as you possibly can get in the US, which is basically any B2B opportunity, right? Anybody that provides health insurance to their employees, which is a fairly large market. And you guys maxed out at 250 SDRs.
Yeah.
So like there's a theoretical maximum. I don't imagine too many people are going to be hitting 250 SDRs this year. I'm sure there will be some. You can build a very healthy business just on outbound, but when you start to get into the big leagues and it's winner take all, you've got to be stacking all these channels, and that's inbound, that's outbound, that's direct mail, that's shit knocking on doors if that's going to be, you know, provide a really good CAC for you.
Yeah. And I think that goes back to the playbook you're building, right? Like part of your playbook is your channels. And if you're fully sort of hedged on one channel, you're not going to be in great shape. And I think that's where you need to start thinking at this hypergrowth stage. You're building out a full playbook across a handful of different channels that all have unique owners, and they have teams that are going, you know, deep on those channels. One of those is outbound and another is inbound. Another, like you said, could be partnerships or whatever the case may be. There's hundreds of channels that I'm sure you guys have discussed on the podcast before and that your listeners are pursuing. But yeah, I think you're right. And so my advice here is not to necessarily continue to pour money into the one thing that's worked, but really focus on continuing to diversify like the investment across all the different plays that you're running.
100%. The one company, and I can't say I've talked to them in the last sort of 6 months, so I don't know exactly where they are. And I'm trying to look up their jobs page right now is Drift. We had David Cancel on the show, and he was talking about how him and Aaron were basically going back and forth over, you know, should they have an SDR team? And they didn't have an SDR team quite yet. And he didn't think they were ever going to go in that direction. And I'm looking and I'm not seeing any account. I see account execs, I see account managers, directors, and I've seen some things called conversational something or other.
Yeah. Well, I think when your product is specifically designed to generate meetings for your like AE team, I think that, you know, I think we'll give it a pass, but it's a fair point. And I think that's awesome. Like I think this is definitely not a one size fits all type of model. And, you know, I was thinking to myself, man, I knew there was one company out there that did this all on outbound. And I remember the name was GuideSpark, where they basically were an all outbound team. And there was really kind of no, I think Shep Mayer was the VP of sales there. And it was a very like outbound type of a play, and that scaled, you know, for a long, long time. But I think in general, scaling on one type of a channel is probably not a great strategy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a good call. I haven't talked to Shep, but we had John Parisi on the show.
Sure.
And it was one of my really, really early guests, cause this must've been over 2 years ago. And yeah, they had a massive SDR team.
Yeah.
So what are some common stumbling, like where do people get stuck at this stage?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the goal is to win the market. So if you don't win the market, you got to get stuck and you got to figure a few things out, right? What if you know, at this point it starts to become pretty clear who's the number one, the number two, number three, that kind of a thing in the space. And so, if you're over indexed and you can kind of get exposed, if maybe you've overhired or overstaffed a little bit, that can get you stuck. If you don't continue to develop and innovate and find new plays and new sales motions, like I think that's one of the tough things. Like if you've gone on the journey from product market fit to repeatability and scale, now to hyper growth, I mean, you've lived a lifetime in like 3 years or however many years it's been, right? You've gone on the journey. You've probably got more gray hairs than you came in with. Like it's been a journey. And I think that for most people, like this is a very reasonable time to kind of be looking at it, whatever may be in the next stage of your life. Who knows? Like, I think it does get a little bit personal too. So I think you have to kind of ask yourself, do I want to buckle down and get to that next stage, right? And win this market. And there are not a lot of people that have done that from sort of stage one all the way through. I mean, typically you see churn, you know, at these different levels and new leaders come in. So I think you know, if you're a leader who's made that jump from repeatability and scale to hyper growth, like you have to continue to do those things that have worked for you in the past and be really relentless on delegating and getting people that are better than you into the organization to focus on, you know, owning things that aren't yours to own anymore, and continue and be really, really dedicated to like innovating and trying out your new sales plays and building that sales playbook out. And now that you've got the capital and sort of like the backing to and the revenue to back it up, like invest in that, right? And like invest in those different channels and those different plays. So I think that those are probably the two stumbling blocks that can get in the way. But I mean, just the being on that journey alone and sort of your own mental psyche and kind of where you're at personally, emotionally, all that, like, I think that's probably the biggest one.
So basically get to this level and then milk it for,
it depends. It depends on what you want, right? Like, I think, that is one way to do it, but, you've come this far, you know, why not keep going?
For sure. And there are only a certain amount of people that actually get the opportunity to make that journey. And there are certain people that, you know, like there's nothing wrong with getting to a certain level and they're like, you know what, this is my sweet spot. I like it here. Right. I don't have to be a CRO at a, you know, Fortune 500 company. Cause that's a dramatically different job from where you started. And that's not something we're not even going to cover on the podcast, but even getting to say VP of sales at a hyper growth or CRO at a hyper growth company, you know, where you've raised a few $100 million, like that's a dramatically different role from where we started at the beginning of the show. So I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's trying to figure out where is it, like you said earlier in the show, where are my superpowers? What are the activities that I can be doing where I'm going to have the most fun and have the biggest impact?
Yeah. And I think that what you just said right there, having the most fun, that's really important. Like you've learned a ton on this journey now, right? And if you're in this position, you're somebody who's very ambitious and you're somebody who has high expectations of yourself and you're somebody who wants to keep growing. And so hopefully you're not bored, right? Like I think that is also a little bit of a death kiss is, you know, this becomes about execution and it becomes, you know, you pass the repeatability stage and this becomes about execution, execution, execution. And so you got to make sure to continue to keep it interesting for yourself too. And I think that, you know, we could go on and on about how to go about keeping it interesting from a personal level. But, I think it is something that people underestimate.
For sure. Ravi, I feel like I could just keep talking to you for a couple hours here. This has been so valuable. But I know you only have a certain amount of time in your day, and so do I. And so I want to get to our sort of last round here, which is just the lightning round. I want to get a couple of quick answers from you on some of the questions we asked the guests. So without further ado, how do you get people to reply to your emails?
Make it easy for them to reply. I jumped into an outbound role right out of college. It was the first thing I ever did. My emails were too long and the questions were too vague. And so I cut it down, and it's got to be pretty simple, like two scrolls of the iPhone max. The ask has to be really clear, and you got to make it personal and make it seem like, you know, make them understand that you did your research and you can kind of sit on that side of the table and understand what they're thinking about.
Right on. So let's say you sent somebody an email. Now they didn't respond. You're cold calling to follow up. You got them on the phone, but they're giving you the brush off. How do you do that?
Level with them, right? I get it. This is a cold call. I caught you out of the blue. And then get to the point, right? The reason for my call is, and then kind of draw out exactly what that reason is.
Beautiful. And finally, what do you do when you need to push at the end of the quarter?
Oh man, the end of the quarter was yesterday, and I'm already getting this question. So honestly, stay hydrated. I think it's easy to just like over caffeinate and over celebrate or any of those things. I stay hydrated and I get sleep. I'm getting older, so like these things are becoming more important to me. And just taking care of my own personal well-being. I think that's about being a professional, right? And showing up every day and having sort of like your own balance. Making sure I have my buyer's cell phone numbers. So if I don't have like a cell phone number for the person that I am working a deal on and it's the end of the month, then I haven't really done my job. And if I'm not like texting with that person and sort of constant communication, then again, I'm probably not doing my job well. And then, you know, at the end of the day, we talked about it earlier in the podcast, but I've got contingencies in place. I'm expecting everything to go wrong. I'm expecting somebody to quit or someone to go on vacation at the last minute and not have told me. I'm expecting it all to sort of unravel, but, hopefully I've got contingencies in place where, again, I know what my odds are and I know what my conversion rates are. And you know, if I've got enough deals and enough pipeline in the right place, then it's going to work out for me.
I think the mark of the more experienced sales leaders that I talk to is this sort of proactive pessimism.
Cautious optimism is what I like to call it, but I think it's probably closer to that.
Because I don't know, that maybe that's just how I feel. Is like, you know, I hear these younger reps tell me, oh yeah, this one's going to close, that one's going to close. And I'm like, no. I'm like, I've seen crazier shit than that go south. Like, it's not locked down until the money's in the bank. And so what can you do? You got to be proactive and have a ton of contingency. So I love that last one.
Yeah.
Ravi, last segment here. I want to give you a chance to pitch, promote, share anything that you're up to. So let's, in the most sales podcast way possible. So let's role play.
Okay. Let's do it.
So who am I? What are you? What are we like? What's the call about here?
Sure. You are an early stage founder who just closed your Series A. And you probably now have some revenue goals that you need to go attack, and you don't really know where to start.
Perfect. All right. Ready?
So, hey, Colin, this is Ravi with Buena Vista Ventures. Congrats on your recent Series A raise.
Thanks, Ravi.
Yeah. So I'm imagining you probably got some revenue goals that you're thinking about as you guys start to turn the corner and thinking about product market fit. And basically what I do is I've had the chance to work with, you know, a handful of organizations firsthand. And now I basically consult going from the product market fit phase all the way through repeatability and growth to hyper growth and helping kind of get around some of those missteps and potholes and things that can go wrong in the early days by focusing on the things that work. And would love to talk to you a little bit more about how you're thinking about go to market.
I was really trying to find an objection in there, but I heard you on this great podcast. So obviously I'd love to have you.
Wow. What a turn of events. Wow.
I got to say the only time anybody's accused me of like black magic was about 5 years ago. Aaron and I had just started working together and we cold emailed this guy and he's like, how did you do it? I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, I literally just ordered your book yesterday. He's like, is Amazon sharing with you? I was like, no, this is just dumb luck. I'm like, we put you on a list. I happened to email you. And so.
That's amazing. It's helpful to have a really good brand behind you. That's for sure.
It did feel like in the early days, we definitely cheated our way through through some of the earlier stuff that we had to work through, right? Like, especially on the product market fit stage, it solved so many problems for us. And I almost feel like I cheated myself as a sales leader entrepreneur. I mean, in a good way. Hey, I'm not gonna complain, but it certainly helps. Robbie, I can't thank you enough. We went way longer than I had promised. I told you I'd get you off the phone a lot, or off the Zoom a lot earlier, but I really appreciate you going into such depth. This is I really, really enjoyed this. And I think you've got a really unique perspective that we haven't had too many guests on that have the similar experience. So I understand with Buena Vista, you're actually helping companies sort of walk through each of these stages and cover what we did on the podcast. So if they're listening, they're like, yeah, I'm struggling with X, Y, Z. What's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Probably LinkedIn. Or you can find me on Twitter, just _ Robbie Allen. And yeah, reach out. I mean, I've, to be honest with you, somewhat stumbled into this consulting world by just sort of getting a request, and it's been going really well. And I've had a really fun time working with a range of different companies to get things right in the early days and focus on the right things. So yeah, just reach out to me directly on LinkedIn, and that'd be great. Thanks for having me. This has been really fun.
Right, man. Thanks for coming on, and see you all next week.